This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come?
This is Wade Rathke, and we're on Wade's World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time in the United States, and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KABF 88.3 is located, or the east side of New Orleans, where WAMF 90.3 is housed, or now on our international station, acornradio.org, or in Greenville, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at all of those frequencies, and www.kabf.org. A podcast will be available, the show, on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Betsy Leandar Wright, who is the board chair of Class Action and also a professor in Massachusetts at LaSalle College. Welcome to Wade's World, Betsy.
Thanks so much, Wade. Delighted to be with you.
Well, and it's our pleasure. So first, let's talk about what's Class Action. This is a legal firm? I mean, that sounds like a lawsuit, but I bet that's not what we're talking about.
No, we are quite different from a law firm. We're a national nonprofit that tries to get people to think more about social class and classism. Our URL is classism.org because we feel like, we've made some progress in our country on talking about gender and sexism, and made some progress talking about race and racism, and we still are a country that just avoids talking about the class divides among us and how do we work together across class for a fairer economy and a better society. So, we do a lot of workshops and bring people together across class divides for cross-class dialogue.
Because there's a whole major industry in trying to argue that class just doesn't exist, that we're unique in the United States. We just don't have the kind of class issues you might have in the old world, England or, Germany or wherever. And you're not finding that true.
We're so not finding that true. Yeah, we're supposed to be this classless land of opportunity, but of course it matters tremendously what social class you're born into, that you have your starting line in life is much farther ahead if you come from highly educated people with a lot of elite contacts or family with money. That's like a farther ahead starting line, and lots and lots of majority of working class people are starting from a farther back starting line and have realistically greater odds, greater obstacles to prosperity and success. And even more, it's just an international scandal what a high percentage of our kids are growing up in poverty. So, we feel like that's a tremendous injustice, and there's people of all classes, from the poorest to the richest, who really, really want to change the way our society is working and make it fairer. But we don't do a good job working together. So there's lots of think tanks and nonprofits that work on what the problems are, but how do we build a social movement that's truly cross-class and has the strengths of all classes? Very few people think about that, and Class Action does.
So the distance, the level of inequality is rising, through the top now. So your inbox just must be flooded every day with people wanting to have whatever workshops Class Action provides. Is that the case or no? Oh, okay. I'm surprised.
Yeah.
Okay. So
absolutely delighted to have that answer. Well, yeah. No, there's so many organizations, institutions in the not-for-profit sector whose missions imply you you know, that they serve everyone, or they in fact are working against inequality. So colleges, of course, they're like, we provide opportunity for all students regardless of their background. And social service agencies are like, you know, we want to listen to the voices of the clients and the people who use the services. And there's religious denominations that say, you know, we see the light of God in everyone. And then they realize that their practice
is all the opposite.
Is yes, that they're reproducing the inequalities, that it's their mission to reduce the way they do things culturally inside their organization. Their organizational policies and practices are in fact reproducing or even making worse the classism of the wider society. So that's class action's constituency, is people who mean well. Foundations, for example, like, do you let your giving be guided by the people who have the needs in the community, or are all the ideas coming from the donors? So we tend to get a lot of requests and for help from people who want to be truer to their mission.
Let's talk about colleges and universities, because that's obviously, there's been a lot of publicity without a lot of progress about how various institutions are trying to diversify their intake of new students by finally accepting more lower-income students. Yet, after many years, I know I read a recent article in the Times, the needle's not budging. So when you're asked to go, or you and your team are asked to go to colleges and universities, are you finding something that works?
Yeah, so there's this phenomenon of the huge influx of first-generation college students. So kids from working class or poverty backgrounds, whose parents didn't go to college. We had this enormous surge since the 90s of the numbers going to college, which, you know, for sometimes that's everybody needs to go to college is kind of ridiculous. I think really what we, that's, anyway, it's a bigger story that people are fleeing.
We'll have to talk about that another show.
Another show, yeah. But
we go into the weeds here, we may never come out, Betsy.
We may never come out. Yeah. But so first-generation college students can thrive, can succeed, can graduate, and go on to the careers of their dreams. Typically only with a lot of support. Only with peer support of other first-gen students, only with acknowledgement that they do face more obstacles than continuing generation students, with whether it's financial support, academic support, social support, cultural orientation, that's what Class Action gets involved with, is we advise many, many colleges on how to support first-generation college students for their own success, and for the culture of the college changing to have more of their strengths too. So we just last weekend had our annual Northeast Summit, dozens and dozens of colleges, a lot of student-led groups, proud first-gen college students presenting about what they do, how they give each other support, and also professional student success programs, often staffed by people who are first-gen students themselves. So, so we do that conference every year. We'd love to expand it to other regions of the country, but at this point it's only happening in the Northeast, but we're talking to people around the country. And, you know, just these small interventions of first-gen support groups and, specialized problem-solving for the obstacles that they may face. That is one of our major successes, as I think we've turned things around at a number of colleges.
Well, that's good to hear, because, certainly in my real life, I'm an organizer. So reading something recently that said the recruitment efforts of college and universities were largely within the demographics of who they already had, not prep schools, schools in largely upper income, upper middle class, white areas, and, outreach, no duh. If you really want lower income, working class students, you really have to go where they are if you want them to come to their schools. Yet they're not doing the recruitment effort. So, yeah, I mean, it's great to hear you're making progress supporting them once they get in, but are you making any progress, you know, whipping them into shape to actually go out into areas where working class students and low-income students are in order to recruit them?
In some cases, yes.
Great.
A number of schools have gone need blind so that they decide on their applicants. Like we, Class Action worked for several years with Amherst College before they went need blind. And of course, they're more heavily endowed. Not every college can do this, but they accept based on the qualities, the special qualities of the student, and then by affirmative action, and then later they figure out how to enable people to afford it. We've also influenced colleges to have class as well as race affirmative action. When you use race only affirmative action, which most schools do, they do extra outreach to get applicants of color, and they look harder and give extra support, you know, extra credit to applicants of color. If you're a highly selective school and you only use that race-based affirmative action, you end up getting well-off, you know, upper-middle-class African-Americans, wealthy international students filling up those affirmative action slots. And so race-only affirmative action ends up harming working class and poor people of color, applicants of color, as well as working class and poor white applicants. So the best for true diversity, race and class diversity, is to practice affirmative action for both race and class.
Right on. So we're talking to Betsy Leandar Wright, who's the board president of Class Action. And what actually drew me to reach out to you, though, wasn't these efforts about that Class Action is involved in. Oh, this is fascinating. But you actually have a background in activism before you entered the academia. Is that correct?
Yeah. I primarily worked for progressive nonprofits and volunteered as an activist since I was young, so about 30 years, as I primarily identify as a community organizer and an issue activist, primarily on economic justice. And that's what drew me into academia is I realized that movement groups were just doing a terrible job building cross-class coalitions. I had been in so many movements I'd been in. I just saw people fracturing along class lines. And I wanted a how-to manual that tell me how to have better practices at cross-class alliance building. And I couldn't find it, so I...
had to write it.
I had to write it. So I wrote a non-academic book called Class Matters. It's like a handbook. I just said to people, like, you know, what works? I interviewed a bunch of good cross-class organizers and put together this non-academic sort of magazine-style book that's it's mostly out of print, but you can still get it from Class Action. And everyone had questions for me who went to the book tour events and read the book of, like, what do you mean? I said there are activist class cultures. We are culturally different in our activism. It has to do with the classes we come from, and that is getting in our way. And that's the thing I got the most questions about after the first more informal book. People are like, well, what are these class culture differences? And people were arguing with me about what I thought they were. And they're like, no, that's not true for us in the African-American community. For us, the class issues are these. Or us in the South, you sound like you're talking from the North. So people were just pouring into my brain. Yeah.
And pushing back hard, it sounds like.
Pushing back, yeah, but in an intrigued way, not like just like I was wrong, but like we all really want to know what are the cultural differences, I mean, the different ways of talking, different ways of running meetings, different ways of relating to each other, the different sort of social norms in activist groups of different social classes, because we need to understand that to be able to be bridge people and pull people together into coalitions. So I said, okay, well, I need to write that book, and that book's going to be hard because I need to go all different parts of the country. I need to really use great social science research methods. So I quit my day job and went back to grad school and got some smart sociologists to train me how to do ethnographic field work and then how to analyze interview data. I got transcripts of recorded meetings for 25 groups, and I interviewed about 60 people. I interviewed multiple people from every group, and I just did this multi-year project. And I was then, by looking really carefully at similarities and differences across issues, big groups, small groups, different states, I was able to find some patterns where in working class led, majority working class membership groups, I found common ways of doing things that showed up over and over again, different types of groups that really do constitute a working class activist culture. And then I found common ways of doing things among professional middle class, you know, people with college-educated parents and college-educated themselves, really common ways of doing things. And then I had this interesting subset of people who were voluntarily downwardly mobile anarchists who tended to come from the highest class backgrounds, and I found really common ways of doing things for them, too. And so I wrote this book, Missing Class, and I think it's really useful. Some of it's very detailed, small things about how humor is used, what it means to facilitate or chair a meeting, really small cultural differences. But I believe that if you understand those, you then can be a chameleon. You can be a bridge person. You can go into activist groups of different classes and not have culture clashes and understand how things are working, and you can create a coalition that's comfortable for everybody, including the people who are typically marginalized. Working class and poor people are often marginalized. So it was gave me a lot of hope. I feel much more hopeful about cross-class coalitions now than I did when I was just an activist where lots of them were not going so well.
Well, and if you're going to build a mass-based organization, it's important to recognize these things. So just to translate this in a different way for our listeners, there's a difference that you found in your work between what you called coffee and donuts organizing versus what we might call wine and cheese organizing. So is there a way to break out some of what the coffee and donuts world is like versus wine and cheese?
Absolutely. I'll tell one detail where I like your characterization of the coffee and donuts, but one of the weaknesses of the more class privileged groups is the absence of cheese and absence of wine. So I found that food was this big difference. So one really common problem faced by all activist groups is how do we get more people involved? You know, that's just everyone is like low turnout, people disappear, and we can't recruit enough new ones. Every group is smaller than it wants to be, right? So I would ask people, so what would you do to get more people involved? That was a standard interview question. And there was this theme among lifelong working class people, but also some of the straddlers, some of the people who were college educated but grew up working class, that by far the most common answer was food and entertainment, like make the meetings inherently pleasurable. So better food, advertise the food, have some kind of fun activity or entertainment. Get people in the door out of like self-interest, and then when they're there, you connect with them, you build a relationship with them, and so forth. This has got to be a coincidence because it was excessively strong correlation, but not one single lifelong professional middle-class person or person from these more class-privileged movements, like environmental groups and so forth, anti-war movements, not one single person mentioned food. And in fact, at their meetings, there were meetings that were at 6 o'clock at night where people are sitting around, all these college-educated professional activists are sitting around saying, how do we get more people involved? How do we get more people involved? And there's not a calorie in the room. It's not 100% true that there's never food, but sometimes people went and got individual food. Like, they'd leave, get individual slices of pizza, and come back. So
and eat in front of everybody else, huh?
yeah. There was shared food at every single meeting run by and populated by working class and poor people. So here, that's like to me the quintessential example of how you can benefit from knowing a different activist class culture. That some of those people who didn't have their wine and cheese in the room with them, maybe that's what they ate at home. They could have an immediate benefit by going to some working class and poverty groups and being like, oh, look at this. They did it as a potluck. Look at this. They ordered in some pizzas. Look at this. Somebody cooks some beans from home and brings them in. Or somebody passes around bags of potato chips. Look at this. And look at this. On their flyer for the meeting or their email for the meeting, they say the food is going to be great. You know, that's like to me an example of how if you know how other classes do things, you can get some great solutions to your common problems. And foodlessness to me seems like a form of organizational classism. Like we have cultural assumptions built into some activist groups, and it's harming recruitment, it's harming who's there, it's harming how inclusive it is. So nobody was intending to be exclusionary by not having food. You know, they're just staggering in from work themselves and tired and whatever. But it's practices that end up being exclusive to one class culture.
It's interesting how you have to, I do a lot of organizing work internationally now, how you have to unlearn some lessons you know from North America. In Africa, we had to deliberately and aggressively say we would not have any food there because...
Really?
Yeah, NGOs, the way NGOs organize is they always provide food and money to people to come to meetings in slum areas, rather than doing outreach or actually doing work. So that's the draw. And so we had to very aggressively, if we were going to build a membership organization, we were very clear. There would be nobody would be paid to come to a meeting. You're going to actually pay dues, and there wouldn't be food, at least in the organizational part of the organization, because if not, they would think we're just a giveaway, charity group. We're not a real lower-income people's organization. So,
people's organization.
Yeah, so yeah. That we weren't going to be other. We were going to be them. So it's we had to learn the opposite. We're talking to Betsy, and Betsy, was I mispronouncing your name? I sort of heard something as I was saying before.
Oh, yeah, it's Leander Wright with the accent on the on.
You know, luckily you told me how to do the accent on LaSalle versus LaSalle, but I could sort of hear as I was saying it that I was butchering your name. But Betsy has been talking to us about class and how class not only affects everything in this country and others, but also we're talking deeply how it affects activism and people trying to build change. One of the things you spent a lot of, I actually stumbled onto your book, and that's part of why we're talking today, but you had a lot of things you said about straddlers. What are straddlers?
Yes. So straddler, the term was coined by Al Lubrano, who wrote the book Limbo. He's a straddler. It's people who straddle two classes, but the specific kind of straddling two classes is coming from a working class or poverty background and being the first generation of your family to go to college and get a get a four-year degree or more and working in professional jobs. And Stradlers have a real special view on class culture and bridge and class differences because, you know, they've been in multiple classes themselves. In my favorite book about the Stradler point of view and how it can be good for movement building is Barb Jensen in Classes. She's a Stradler. She's very proud of her working class roots. She sees a lot of positive things about working class culture, but she also appreciates a lot of things about the professional middle class culture that she has joined as a psychologist. And so the view from the Stradlers is, I think Stradlers have the capacity to be really good bridge people.
That's the heart of my question. Are they helpful in building organizations, or are they an impediment?
Yeah, I went in assuming I was going to find just the positive version, which I certainly have known lots of people like that who can kind of translate, you know, they can talk the way their neighborhood talked and their cousins talk, and which makes them great community outreach people, and they can relate to the threes of change, the more abstract ways of talking of the professional middle class activists. So I definitely found some of those class bicultural bridge people. I was super surprised to discover that there were also people who kind of brought the downsides of their two class cultures. I found these people that are very, very angry members of activist groups who kind of have the, I think there's a tendency to be too abstract and focused on the ideological purity. It's a pitfall of being an upper middle class activist, that you focus on the ideology instead of the people, and you keep things at this abstract level. A lot of us, like me, who come from that background, we have to really unlearn those habits. But there are some people who take them on with a vengeance and fuel them with a working-class rage. And working-class rage can be a great thing, but there are some people who learn a kind of belligerence of fighting first, bring that from their background. They're not typical of their working class communities. They're often men who are seen by other working people as kind of, you know, too little taste of toxic masculinity. I don't want to overgeneralize, but they put those two things together, and they were the divisive people who were.
Yeah, it's not a good combination.
Everyone else, yeah. Not a good combination. So as all class cultures have strengths, all class cultures have limitations. And what we're trying to get is this is just human, we all need to try to leave the limitations that we get from our upbringing behind and embrace the strengths and bridge to the strengths that other people have. So I actually found both kinds of Stradlers acting in positive ways. I call them uprooted and unassimilated Stradlers were a little bit of a harmful force. Well, one of the healthy things about working class organizing is that so many people enter activism in a rooted kind of way that it tends to be connected to pre-existing affiliations with, you know, a workplace if it's labor organizing or a neighborhood, or a town if it's community organizing. Lots of people join with multiple members of extended families or friends. And so there's a real habits of accountability to each other Like, you can't trash and burn the organization because you're going to still see those people, you know.
So, we had so many questions, Betsy. I wanted to get into loyalty and language, but we're running out of time.
Yeah.
I want you to let people know how they can get a hold of Class Action again and where they can find your book before we leave.
Okay, sorry, I'm talking to
No them. Problem. We could have gone on forever, but go.
Okay, so classism.org, Class Action's website. And
spell that out, please, book, so that people know how to do
yes,
that.
CLASS, like class, and then ISM, like this is one of the isms, is classism. Classism.org. If you then click store, I really appreciate when people buy both my books, Missing Class and the earlier one, Class Matters, through Class Action, because instead of Amazon.
Exactly right. Thank you so much, Betsy. It's been a pleasure to have you. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.